Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning in to the conversation on this Aloha Friday, July 10th. Today we bring you a multimodal transportation show exploring the history and the ways we travel via planes, trains, and automobiles. A flashback to World War II and a gesture of gratitude from across the globe, we get a glimpse of the Mercy Boxcar, a labor of love from volunteers at the Eva Railway Society and the Daughters of the American Revolution. Miniature remote control cars have been around for eons, but what's this about drift races? We go along for the ride. And we hear stories from the cockpit. A long-retired Hawaiian Airlines pilot looks back in a year of big changes for the airline. And start your engines, we take you out for a look back at the racing scene on Oahu.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
This July, experience HPR's Live from the Atherton Classical Concert Series. On July 18th, violinist Yuri Hughes joins pianist Jasmine Nagano for an intimate recital. Then on July 25th, vocalist Kaylin Howard and pianist Brian Bethia take the stage for an evening of classical song and piano. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Academy of Recording Arts, HARA, committed to preserving and protecting Hawaii's recording industry and the music of Hawaii. Learn more at harahawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're sharing stories about planes, trains, and automobiles. Back in 2025, we jumped on a historic train out on the Eva Plain. It was to pay homage to World War II history. HPR was there on a Sunday afternoon as the Hawaiian Railway Society rededicated the Mercy Boxcar. It's a World War I era artifact located at its base yard and museum at the end of Renton Road. The boxcar was preserved but stored outside where the elements had not been kind to it. It has now been restored thanks to the members of the Society and the Daughters of the American Revolution here in Hawaii. Historian Jeff Livingston shared the story of the friendship train that was sent over as a thank you for the generous gift of sugar sent to France as it tried to rebuild after the Second World War. The project was the brainchild of Washington Post columnist Drew Pearson, and the restoration of the French boxcar is a nod to that heartfelt history of aloha and mahalo, dating back some 75 years ago.
It was a grassroots, citizen-to-citizen, non-government effort to help the people of France, Belgium, Italy, and even Germany after World War II. And the collection of clothing, non-perishable goods, medicines, and everything else was donated directly by individual people. It wasn't a huge corporate government event whatsoever. And he thought that originally, maybe if he got 25, 30 boxcars, that'd be good. But because he's a syndicated columnist, the idea took off across the country and the territory of Hawaii at the time. He wound up with 700 boxcar loads of goods.
That's incredible. The heartfelt donations.
Yes. I mean, throughout the country, people recognized that Europe had been devastated by this conflict, and they wanted to help on an individual level. And Hawaii had just gone through the same war, but they did so a little differently because they were under martial law. A lot of things were different in Hawaii. Everybody experienced rationing, but things were a little tougher here. And the folks here in Hawaii wanted to participate. And in a matter of a couple of weeks, they collected money, pennies, nickels, dimes, quarters, sure there were a few dollars thrown in there, but they raised sufficient money in about 2 weeks to buy two boxcar loads of sugar to be sent as part of the American Friendship Train. The sugar was loaded in California at C&H Sugar. They were a little shy of two boxcar loads, and C&H kicked in the remainder, and the sugar made its way to Europe. In 1948, French railway worker André Picard felt that there should be something done in return, and he wanted to send the train back. The French government got behind the effort. It grew. The French National Railway got behind the effort, the SNCF, and because of the association of the World War One era boxcars and the World War One doughboys who served in France, the 40 and 8s, 40 men or 8 horses, 49 of the World War One era boxcars were dug out from whatever depots they could find them in and refurbished as the Merci train or thank you train. The citizens of France, they donated goods, family heirlooms, china, silverware, paintings, documents, wanted to give something back to the level of scrub brushes. Children gave their toys. They had very little to begin with, but they gave whatever they possibly could, just like the citizens of Hawaii had done. So the cars arrived, all 49 of them, in New York on the 2nd of February, 1949, and there was one car for every state, and then one car was shared between Washington, D.C. and the territory of Hawaii. Half the gifts were distributed in Washington, and the other half came to Hawaii. And the boxcar itself arrived in Hawaii in November of 1949. It was turned over to the American Legion, and was displayed at their post on Lacaulay Street. It came out to the rail yard at Hawaiian Railway Society sometime in the early 1980s, and the society took custody of it in 1998. No work was done to the car. The society was focused on equipment that was used in Hawaii or made in Hawaii, and a French boxcar just didn't fit into that particular category. One guy recognized its importance and did his best to save it, Glenn Holton, our late director of restoration. Glenn did get a restoration effort started, and it was with the help of MercyTrain.org folks who had come out to visit the car. Earl Bennett Sr., who was the founder of MercyTrain.org, he came out to see the car, and one of his goals was to see all of the 43 remaining boxcars, and the Hawaii car was his 43rd and last boxcar to visit. Unfortunately, Earl passed away shortly thereafter. That's what generated the support from MercyTrain.org in donations to get this car restored. Glenn did get the restoration effort started with the help of the Aloha Chapter, Daughters of American Revolution primarily, and Jane Mann, who at the time was the state regent. She made this her project, and the ladies of the DAR did an extensive amount of work removing rust and priming. It's definitely a part of Hawaii's history. Hawaii's history is so rich and so diverse from that point on. It may not always be pretty, but it is interesting, it's important, and it needs to be preserved. And this is an artifact that shows the people of Hawaii, this multicultural mix that we live within, is imbued with that spirit of aloha. It doesn't matter where you came from. Once you're here, it seems to grow on you. At least it is definitely growing on me. And that is such an important concept, at least in my mind, that everybody has a share in everybody else. And we should all be thinking of the other all the time. That's what makes Hawaii such a wonderful place to live. We've been there over 40 years, and our clientele is primarily families. They come out, they enjoy the day, and we encourage everyone to come out and join us for a train ride. The train ride is fully narrated. It's quite interesting. You learn about the history of the area and the history of the railroad.
That was Jeff Livingston sharing the history of the Merci boxcar that was restored thanks to the efforts of countless volunteers after 75 years. This story originally aired in February 2025. The boxcar is on display in the base yard of the Hawaiian Railway Society. Look for links on our website later today. Picture a car drift race. Now shrink it to 1/10 of the scale. There's a small but tight-knit community of remote-controlled car drifting here in Hawaii. With a remote control, drivers control cars around the racetrack, where the objective is to swerve, veer, and drift the car without losing control. We revisit a story that we aired last summer. The Conversation summer intern, Laura Dukes, attended a practice run at Ainakoa Park in East Honolulu, where members of the RC Drift Team Psycho were preparing to attend the Super Drift Championship in California. Roy Urata is one of the crew's co-founders.
Okay, so Roy, explain what I'm looking at here.
Okay, so we're going to watch this pair right here. So the lead car, he's going around the course. We don't really have like the full zones set up tonight. Normally you'll have like a box on the ground that will designate where we want the lead car to slide through. If it's on the outside of the lane, we want him to slide through it with the back tires. And if it's on the nose or the front part of the lane, we would want the front part of the car to slide through that box. Generally, we want the car to slide through each turn without straightening out. If they straighten out, that would be like an incomplete. Same if they spin out. And in this instance, so like how the blue car is following that white car, he's just trying to mimic the movements of the white car. Oh, see, and it's like he spun out, so that would be incomplete for the lead car. But ideally, yes, everybody's just trying to follow the car in front of them as close as they can without making any contact.
These tiny cars are nothing like Hot Wheels or penny racers. A basic drifting car will set you back $500. Serious drifters will pay up to $6,000 to trick out their vehicles. The local Hawaii drifting community has more than 50 drivers and is even expanding to the neighbor islands. Duke spoke with Urata about how he got into this micro motorsport.
Hawaii Raceway Park shut down in 2006. And we haven't had a track since, for real cars at least. So that's where some of our friends moved away to the mainland to pursue drifting. And others of us have like just gotten further into remote control. And yeah, still travel for remote control, but we can still practice that here at home.
I think for someone who maybe has never seen drifting before, but knows what a car race is, how is it different?
Drifting is different than regular car racing because there's tire smoke everywhere and the cars are not going straight. They are sliding with like 45 degrees of angle where they look like they would be out of control, but they're just trying to glide around as close to the walls and barriers as they can while putting on a show for the crowd. It's not about who gets to the finish line first. It's more so who can perform what the judges are looking for if you're talking about competition. And then if you're watching a drift event that's just more like a demo or something, it's all about being exciting from a driver's standpoint and putting on a show for the crowd.
I think that's really interesting because I know visually what drifting looks like, but I didn't know it's not a race.
Competition drifting is not racing. I mean, you do have a speed element to it because of the different tire compounds and things like that. But yeah, it's still about being able to fill the zones with as much angle as you can, running the proper line that the judges want you to be on, and getting as close to the barriers as you can.
But RC drifting is a little unique in that it's like taking the image of that and replicating it to the best of its capability, yeah. Smaller.
When we started, all the radio control cars were four-wheel drive, standard touring cars that you would race. But you just put hard tires on and to make them slide. And since then, over those years, it's evolved to have like higher gear ratios in the rear to make the back tires spin faster than the front. The current cars you're looking at now are strictly rear-wheel drive, so they have a big steering angle, like 60 degrees, 70 degrees of steering lock, like how the real pro drift cars do. We use electronics and like a steering gyro to help us catch the initial steering, like we would equate that to being like power steering in a car, but the motors and the speed controls have a lot more adjustment to them now, and even the layouts of the cars weight balance wise are a lot more like the pro drift cars than before.
You saw your first race and that's how you kind of got into drifting. You were hooked from that, but what really drew you in to the uniqueness of RC drifting?
I really liked being able to mimic what I wanted to, well, what I was seeing in videos without the limitations per se of having to drive around on the street because we didn't have a track anymore. And also, I'm into a wide variety of vehicles, so the remote control car, I can keep the same chassis and I can just change the body out every month or every like week if I wanted to, as opposed to changing out the complete car and having to start all over. Yeah, so that really appealed to me. I like being able to drive with my friends, and in reality, even though we crash into each other, the consequences are nothing like what it would be in a real car. I mean, I'm not saying that it would be like life-threatening or anything in a real car if you're on a track, but like we can crash into each other and keep going like it's no problem. You would still have mechanical issues that you'd have to repair in a real car. So, and it's cheaper.
Yeah, I think on that, this is far cheaper than a drifting car.
Yes.
But it's still like, you're still putting a decent amount of work and care into this.
Yes. The cars have a lot of adjustments from alignment to track width, shock setups as far as like how, what kind of oil you want to put in there, different spring rates.
Oil and motors, that's crazy. It sounds like, it really does sound like you're talking about a car.
Yeah, we are. We are talking about a, I guess, an electric car, but yeah, it's got all the same elements to it. This electronic speed control would be basically like an ECU in a regular car. So it has a lot of adjustments that you can make. Changing the gear ratio in this changes the power band, so you can change the how much punch you have when you pull the throttle. Braking setups change. Even the servos now are programmable to have different speeds and things like that. Yeah, you can get really into it and tinker a lot with the different settings, or you can keep it simple and still have fun. Yeah, so just depends on how far you want to take it.
How has like something that you saw as a teenager gotten you here?
I guess I always had passion for drifting. It really appealed to me that I could do this and maintain. A lot of it was how far I wanted to take it. So to me, the remote control car was not so intimidating to get in and learn how to work on it and things like that. So that just promoted me to further progress myself in the hobby. And the friendships that I've built over the years with my team and even friends from around the world now, yeah, they are really important to my life.
What is something that being in this for a while that has kind of like stuck with you or like changed your life in any way?
A lot of the draw to the hobby is the community. You know, life is hectic for all of us nowadays, so it's nice to have a group that shares a common interest and we can come together and kind of blow off steam for a few hours on a couple nights a week. Competitions are very different from a regular practice session because they have to have so much structure, and we have just different points that we have to hit as an organizer to legitimately qualify for the series. But you know, for some, that is what attracts them, and that's totally cool. And at the other end, you have the people who just want to get together and hang out and just enjoy just driving together. And or it can be even like painting and detailing out the different body shells and things. You know, there's a whole community around that too. So there's something for everybody. Drifting appeals to a very wide demographic, not just in age, but just of different people in general. So it's still good to see that it's not all about the money. You can still take a very cheap entry-level car. Like there's a family over there that's just starting out, and they're having just as much fun as somebody that has like a really expensive car. So it's really awesome. The more that people are exposed to that and understand that, the further our hobby will grow in general.
That was Roy Arata. He's the co-founder of the RC Drift Team Psycho. You can also find more info about the team and upcoming races on Facebook at Team Psycho RC. We can also share that our intern, Laura, took a spin controlling Roy's car after their interview. She spun out. If you're just joining the conversation, we're airing a Hanaho show about planes, trains, and automobiles. Stay tuned. Coming up after the break, we revisit a bygone era and hear from the oldest living retired Hawaiian Airlines pilot.
Now if you know,
Support for HPR comes from Ho'olanapua, working to prevent child trafficking through public education about buyer demand and the community's role in reducing exploitation. Resources at ho'olanapua.org.
On the next Science Friday, talking about the gut-brain connection. From new info on how some brain diseases like Parkinson's start in the gut, to fact-checking hashtag gut health claims on social media.
You guys think fiber maxing is cool? Wait till you hear about poop maxing. That's trending.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation. Time flies quickly for most people. Slowing down in life and on the road are opportunities to make memories and for them to last a lifetime.
With the merger of Alaska and Hawaiian Airlines, the company controls nearly half of the traffic between Hawaii and the U.S. continent. The latest change, Hawaiian Airlines has ended free main cabin meals. The changes have put us in a reflective mood. Today, we are hanahoeing our interview with the oldest living retired pilot of Hawaiian Airlines. Gilbert Hicks is 98 years old. He came to Hawaii in 1949 with the U.S. Navy. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender in May about landing in Kahi Lagoon in a Martin Mars flying boat. Hicks was picked up and taken to Barbers Point, and he says the ride was one he'll never forget.
You can imagine in those days, it was just a little old two-lane road from the Pearl Harbor area all the way out to Barbers Point. And, as you know, sugar was king in those days. And so we're driving. It was still so early in the morning. It was still kind of dark, probably early trade wind showers. And the cane was so tall, it practically covered over the whole road. So you think you're driving down a dark tunnel almost through Eva till you got all the way out. So on the way, I was beginning to wonder, what have I gotten myself into? But it all worked out very well. So that's how I arrived on July 15th,
1949. You had already earned your wings at that point.
Yes, I had. So I was assigned to a squadron at Barbers Point, VP-22. We flew the Navy's version of a B-24. It was called a PB-4Y-2. It was designed as a submarine hunter, is what its mission was. So anyway, I arrived at Barbers Point and the sun came out and it was a nice day. My Navy career was pretty short. I was out of the Navy and at Hawaiian Airlines by the following June 1st.
Why'd you join Hawaiian Airlines?
Oh, well, there's a group of us that we all wanted to stay in Hawaii if we could. And we heard that Hawaiian was hiring, which was a usual practice. As the summer approached, the traffic would pick up, and they would hire a few pilots and flight attendants for the summer. And they told you, okay, you're on for the summer, but comes Labor Day, you're furloughed, which was the case. Hiring was a little different. Well, it was different for us. We went in for an interview with Captain Sam Elliott, and he talked to us a little bit. There were two of us. Bill Warren had been a close buddy since 1945. And I said, oh, well, are you boys from Barbers Point? Yes, sir. Oh, okay. You're hired. And by the way, I'll see you down at Fort DeRussy next Tuesday for the Naval Reserve meeting. And here's your application for a correspondence course so you can earn your points. So I'll see you there. Yes, sir, Captain. And we were there. And fortunately, that was good for me because we continued in the Naval Reserve. And that has been a big benefit all over the years. So with that, come June 1st, started at Hawaiian. And at Hawaiian, that's where I wanted to show Mike Machado. His grandfather was teaching us the intricacies of a DC-3 and finally got us trained up to where we were turned loose as co-pilots at Hawaiian.
So initially you were flying inter-island on the DC-3. What some of those routes? Waimea, Hana, Molokai, Lanai?
Oh, yeah, we flew all the airports and Kauai and obviously Oahu and Molokai and Lanai and then over to Maui and then into Hana and then down to Hilo and we flew to Kona, of course.
Commuter flights mainly, tourists? Who are on those planes?
Local business people. And when, yes, of course, tourists, especially during the summertime, we had quite a few tourists. Tourists liked it. In fact, later on, they were always modifying those airplanes a little bit. But we had them, they call it the Viewmaster. It had a long window on each side. And we were giving day tours with that as best we could, fly around the islands, and you could dip the wing and the people on could go either side, and people could get a pretty good look at the islands. And then they would always land on those tours, and then they would the lunch would probably be a big attraction. And we made, over the years, made a couple of unusual trips. Well, one was one of the plantations thought they would try grazing pineapple on the big island. And in fact, this was in 1950. The first year there. So you take the top of a pineapple and put that in the ground and you grow another pineapple. Well, so we spent 3 days ferrying pineapple tops from Maui over to Opola Point. So I never saw so many pineapples. I didn't know there were that many pineapple tops. They had just huge piles of them on Maui and load those onto the plane and we'd take them over to Opola. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look, pineapple growing on a big island never took off. So there's no pineapples growing on the big island. But flying in and out of Opola Point was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
It's not the longest runway in the world by any means, but it may be the windiest, one of the windiest.
So at one point, as you're flying for Hawaiian, you meet a college girl who is spending the summer as a flight attendant. Tell us about Patsy.
Yes, to my good fortune, I met Patsy Conahilly. That was in 1950, I guess. Ruby Pua, who had been a house mother at Kamehameha, was now the chief flight attendant at Hawaiian. And so she hired a lot of Kamehameha girls. Patsy was a class of 46 graduate of Kamehameha. And now she was, of course, in college. And so after the summer, she went back to and graduated from Berkeley. And we were married in 52. And I thought it was quite an accomplishment for what they taught kids at Kamehameha in those days to go on to Berkeley. She was a smart lady. And the odd trips of the DC-3, well, of course, everybody remembers the one where the baby was born on the airplane. We took off from Maui, and the flight attendant came up and said, "Hey, this woman back here says she's having a baby." So you can imagine two guys up in a cockpit. Ho, 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 she thinks she's having a baby. Well, I went back to look. Well, my wife had given birth to our son, Art, just a few months earlier, almost in the car. I knew what a woman about to have a baby looked like. So I rushed back to the cockpit and I said, "Yes, she's having a baby." And we obviously turned around back to Maui, called for an ambulance, and landed. The baby was born in the air. The lady just laid down. And we're all very fortunate that that baby was healthy. And not because she was a premature child. They said the ambulance crew, I think the same as our first reaction, they weren't ringing a siren or anything. They were stopping for the stoplights and taking away coming to the airport. But I got to hand it to them. When I got there, they swung into action and took care of the situation. We had later on a first birthday party for her. And then many years later, of course, on her 16th birthday, we took her to Hilo, gave her a ride to Hilo.
We've been hearing from Gil Hicks, the oldest living pilot for Hawaiian Airlines. Hicks and his wife, the late Patsy Kanahele, were married for more than 64 years. This interview aired back in May. We'll have more right after a break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
Aloha, this is Derek Malama. Please join me for the next episode of Kanikapila Vintage, the new podcast from HPR featuring classic editions of Kanikapila Sunday. This week, we hear my 2007 interview with producer John DeMello. He reflects on the voice of Brada Iz, Israel Kamakavivoole. It's available this Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. Sponsored by Manu Healii.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For nearly 90 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Welcome back. We're re-airing a conversation with retired Hawaiian Airlines pilot Gil Hicks, who flew on the airline for nearly 40 years. In that time, he made trips to Christmas Island, Wake, and Midway Atoll, as well as Brussels, Helsinki, and Alaska. But one journey that stands out in his mind was to what was then the Trust Territory of the Pacific Islands, now the Federated States of Micronesia, Republic of the Marshall Islands, Palau, and the Northern Marianas. Hicks tells the story to HPR's Maddie Bender.
The Trust Territory came up for grabs or for a new route. Pan Am had it. And Trust Territory over the century had changed hands several times between Germany and Japan and finally the U.S. And so Pan Am was flying it. So we, the company, put together a team to go out and make application for the Trust Territory route. We took the DC-6 and flew to Wake, to Guam. And from Guam, we went up to Tinian. The island everyone remembers best was Yap Island. Then we went on to the other Trust Territory islands, Truk and Babeldaob. We came on Quaj Majuro and then back down into Honolulu. We were gone, I don't know, 3-4 weeks. But when you go on something like that, you're usually wined and dined everywhere you went. So it was a wonderful trip. Never forget that.
Yeah.
And it's an aside, but my son became a pilot and was with Continental to start with. Oh, by the way, the route went to Continental, mm-hmm. not to Hawaiian.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I should say that. So he was the Continental, and shortly thereafter, he was stationed on Guam and flew the Trust Territory route for Continental. They really liked flying out there because you had the sky to yourself. It wasn't like trying to get into busy New York or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they used to fly Guam up to Japan and back and then on from the, they had a circuit to the Trust Territory, wind up in Honolulu, have a couple of days rest, and then take the circuit back to Guam, and he did that for a few years.
That must have been a proud moment, watching your son fly the route as when you had tried to chart it for Hawaiian.
Yeah, right.
You must have seen all these airlines rise and fall over your time. I mean, there are some that don't exist anymore. There are some so different from how they used to be.
Well, that's true. Like Pan Am.
Yeah.
We used to come in to Pan Am Flight 1 and Flight 2. They used to cross at Honolulu at noon practically every day. And we could, when we were coming in on a flight to land around noontime, you generally hear Pan Am calling in. So many airlines have come and gone. I thought Hawaiian was going to be a holdout, but I see now we've finally merged into Alaska. But, you know, you had like airlines like TWA, you had Eastern and Pan American, of course. Well, now one last vestige of, you all know the building. In fact, it's close by here. Pan Am building.
That's where I parked my car this morning.
Yeah. Well, that, when that building was built, in fact, I knew the architect, Don Chapman. Pan American had their office down there on the ground floor for a while. And then, of course, they started phasing out when the financial troubles turned in. By the way, you know that Hawaiian and Pan American started in the same year, 1929. Going into the Depression.
Wow.
What a year to start an airline. But anyway, they survived for quite a while.
Do you see with the merger as recently as in April, the HA airline code being retired, switching now to AS for Alaska? Is that the end of Hawaiian or what do you think?
I hope not completely. We still think the Pualani tail. Alaska should have been wise to, well, I don't know. That's selfish, I guess. It appears that they're going to keep Pualani inner island, but it'll stay. But all the overseas routes will be strictly Alaskan and Alaskan tail emblem. And they've taken our the 787s that we had. They're going to reconfigure those and use them. In fact, I have a grandson that's with Hawaiian, and he's flying a 787 as a co-pilot. Most of his flights are Seattle to Korea at the present time, anyway. But I just hope the merger works out, because sometimes mergers don't do too well. But I think this one should survive all right. Yeah, I guess for the nostalgia, we'd hate to see the Pualani tail disappear entirely. I think it's one of the prettiest ones out there. And if you look down at, say, Los Angeles someplace, you see a whole bunch of airplanes lined up. Boy, that one always stands out.
Your whole family, then, are airplane pilots. Your son, your grandson.
Yes, I guess so. I said too many pilots. I need some doctors and lawyers. But my son is a pilot. Well, he's retired from Continental. I've merged into United. He's retired now. My daughter was a pilot for Island Air. People that know seniority, she was the number two pilot on their list. And her husband, my son-in-law, John, was a pilot with Hawaiian Airlines, and now retired, of course. Yeah, we had plenty of pilots. And, of course, my wife had started as a flight attendant, aviation household, I guess.
Your granddaughter's here today. I was talking with your son. Like, clearly you have a big family that loves you very much. You've put down roots here. Any advice for people, for listeners?
Oh, well, I don't know. Just be thankful for what you've got, I guess. And I'm very lucky to have so many grandchildren. And my wife and I just had two children, and out of that came 14 grandchildren. And now I see the great-grandchildren. Let's see, we got another one the other day. I got 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, I guess that would make 8. There must be about 8 great-grandchildren now. So, well, one thing it is said, and you see it in the newspaper every day, that the price of paradise has just gotten out of reach for people. You've got to have a very well-paying job to really live comfortably in Hawaii today. And that's very sad, but I guess that's the way of economies these days. If it's a beautiful spot, it gets priced out of reach for the people that made it beautiful, which is too bad.
It's just, what a change thinking about that first car ride through the sugarcane as high as your eye can see to now, I mean, running out of space to build housing.
Yeah, that's right. It's all gone now.
Anything else about your career as a pilot living in Hawaii for so many years? You're 98?
Yeah, 98 now. So, no, it was a wonderful career. Hawaii was a great place to bring up kids. I guess I hit it at kind of the golden age. Anyway, it was really lucky. Nice career. Hawaiian was a great airline to work for. We had great airplanes. We flew and we got into the jets. The DC-9 was a great airplane. Really a wonderful career. Couldn't ask for anything better. I guess when I grew up as a kid, I just had my eyes in the sky. All I could think of was being a pilot, and I was fortunate enough that I became one and enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you so much, Gil Hicks, for your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
That was retired Hawaiian Airlines pilot Gil Hicks reflecting on a 37-year career for the airline and a life well lived. And a note, Hawaiian Airlines is an HPR underwriter. For the first time in two decades, it's looking like there will be a racetrack on Oahu. The city and county of Honolulu announced that it is developing a 20-acre lot into a racetrack atop former U.S. Navy land in Kalailoa. The closing of the Hawaii Raceway Park back in 2006 created a void, leaving motorsports enthusiasts without a venue to enjoy their hobby legally. This update reminded us about a story that we ran back in 2021 about safe alternatives to indulge in the urge to drive fast. HPR's Russell Subiono took the opportunity to find out.
And clean. All right, 285-83, 285-83.
That's some of the sound from the Aloha Stadium parking lot where the Hawaii region of the Sports Car Club of America, the SCCA, held its last solo autocross race of the 2021 season. I first heard the distinctive sounds of the growling exhausts and screeching tires last month as I was making a mundane trip to the grocery store across the street. I was caught off guard because you don't see much advertising for auto racing on Oahu today. And that's because the island's only dedicated motorsports venue, the Hawaii Raceway Park in Kapolei, was shut down over 14 years ago. In fact, Oahu is the only major Hawaiian island without a racetrack.
Okay, my name is Sean Bacaro. I'm from Kaneohe.
All right. And what kind of car do you drive, Sean?
It's a 2013 FRS.
All right. And we're sitting in, what's the official word? Is this the staging area for racers?
It's called the grid.
The grid. And this is where all the cars kind of hang out and wait for their turn?
Right. So they come here, they prep, you know, they get mentally prepared. And then we have a worker here that calls cars one by one to line up at the start.
Am I messing up your mental preparation?
No, not at all.
You get a nice, good adrenaline rush when you're racing through the course.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's your favorite part about racing?
You know, you don't get to do this on the streets, right? Legally. So, I mean, this is where we like to blow off steam, really, and just go all out. It's fairly safe. You hit a cone, it's not really a big deal most of the time. So it's just a way to release some steam and have fun.
If you've never been to a race, it's a large undertaking. From securing the venue, to organizing the racers, to designing the course, to keeping track of the times, I talked with Joy Batista, SCCA Hawaii Region's Chief of Registration, about what's involved with putting together the monthly events. How do you guys design the track? Who puts up the cones? Who does the measurements?
Everyone that races actually has a specific duty. We are all volunteers. We all technically have different skill sets. After a certain amount of years of experience, we actually have someone that is we have different chiefs for different responsibilities, and they have their crews to do certain things. So we do have a chief of course design, and then we have a track setup crew in the morning. So we have now a bunch of people, like three or four people, including the chief of course design, that sets up a course and designs it, And then our safety steward, one of our chief of safety or one of the other people, they, as we're setting up the course every morning, they're the first ones here usually to set up. Chief of safety works with the chief of course design, and they go through it and they make sure that we have specific safety rules that we have to follow, and that's a national type thing. So we have rules, we follow those things, and we just adjust it as we need to.
Does the course change from event to event?
Every month is a different one. And sometimes we'll recycle them at some point with small little changes, so, but at that point, no one remembers them because we race once a month, so it's not like it's a constant thing.
And on average, how many racers do you see come through?
Pre-COVID, we were seeing approximately, I would say, anywhere between 95 and 110 participants. This is not including spectators, but, and that's including also our junior kart program that's on hold for now because of COVID, but we had about nine children under the age, from anywhere between, I think it's around 8 or 9 to all the way to about 16 or 17 that were doing the kart program. So that's including them. You know, currently with COVID, we've actually limited our amount of people just to make it more manageable for us to keep our protocols within check. And hopefully once we clear all the tiers that we can actually go back to our normal thing. But right now we're seeing about 75, and that's pretty much pretty good.
For your junior program, do they drive full-size cars or they have little cars?
That's a good question. I should have said that. I should have clarified. So we actually have, it's a kart program. It's a junior kart program. It's a national program. So then there are certain karts that fall into certain kind of, they have regulations with those, and the children have to wear their, they have race suits and helmets and stuff. So it's a national thing. It's been at the SCCA Nationals for a while, and we have a program here, and it's their way to get into it. And our first junior kart participant that we had, she's now racing a full-size car.
From what you can tell, what is it about racing that these racers come here for? What are they looking for?
It's a combination of a lot of things, and well, this is the only venue that we have here for safe racing or automotive sports right now on Oahu. And so everyone that's, you know, whether you're a gearhead that likes to race or it likes to tweak on cars or tinker with things, or it's a mechanical thing, or it's for the camaraderie or whatever it is, but there's a combination of a little bit of everything. And we have engineers, we have doctors, we have teachers, we have everywhere in between. The stuff that you learn here, we've done driving schools before, it actually helps to make you more aware on the road. It does kind of make you a better driver.
All the important organizational and staffing details aside, the aspect of races with the highest cool factor are, of course, the cars. Yesterday, I watched several sports cars hit the track. A Mazda Miata, a yellow Corvette, and this black Dodge Challenger driven by a guy named Phoenix. I wanted to know more about the kinds of cars that come to their races. So I talked with SCCA Hawaii Region's Solo Autocross Chair, Jennifer Parker.
We have things from everyday drivers to fancy sports cars to trucks, pretty much everything in between, including pure race cars that are not street legal. They get towed in. And it's just a very large range of types of vehicles that are four wheels and can pass our safety check, safety inspection. Your vehicle doesn't need to be registered with the state or safety check, but it does need to pass our technical inspection for safety purposes and ensure that there's no risk of rollover. For example, let's say an SUV. We do not allow SUVs because of their high center of gravity and potential for rollover. So we do have some limitations in what vehicles can participate, but in general, you can take your daily driver, two-seater, four-seater, and take it out for a test.
One of the things I learned about the SCCA's races, just how inclusive and community-oriented the events are. Mia Valero is not just the organization's communication chair, she also gets behind the wheel and takes it to the course. She talked to me about her experience.
What kind of car do you race?
I actually switch around which cars I'm using. Previously, I've used an S2000, Miata, Corvette, Hellcat. We like to switch it up.
And from what I understand, racing is a family affair. Your brother is the car that I was able to put my recorder in. He got some cool sound for me. And from what I hear, your dad is a racer as well. So it's a family thing.
It is absolutely a family thing. My dad is the one that really organizes it and gets us out here every day. He's the car guy. My brother and I are really just out here driving, but we have fun with it too. My dad has grown up around cars, not me in particular, but I'm happy that he's giving us the opportunity to kind of work our way into it as well.
And what does your mom think about it?
She doesn't let us use her car.
I imagine part of it's the adrenaline, and then I imagine part of it's the community as well. What's your favorite part of racing?
For me, it's getting the most out of the car. I am not at all comfortable trying to find the limit when I'm driving on the street. I don't want to do that. I don't have any intention of doing that. So I like it here because it gives me a chance to see where the limit of the car is. It gives me a chance to push and try to gain new skills that I wouldn't otherwise typically be getting on my own.
Right now, the SCCA is part of the present racing scene on the island. The future could be a new proposed dedicated racing venue planned for Kapolei, not far from the old Hawaii Raceway Park. Michael Kitchens is the CEO of BTT LLC, the company managing Circuit Hawaii, the racing complex aiming to open next year.
Our goal is to build an international FIA Grade 3 facility. What that means is that we can have both national, international racing. You know, we can bring in series like, you know, Trans Am, IndyCar, for invitational events, you know, just big events, drifting, Formula D, you know, anything that we can do, but not only racing, but also everything else, community events, you know. We've got an area that we're going to have set aside for hula practitioners, for example. So the idea of what we're trying to do now is change Hawaii for the better from an economic point of view, from an education point of view, training, you know, we're really going to make an impact on the state. And I think that's really important because it's all about regeneration. And it's also about sustainability. It's going to be one of the greenest racetracks on the planet, if not the greenest, sustainably, both from a lead point of view and a well-certified point of view.
Do you have any plans to get into a car and test out that track when it's finished?
Yeah, I better be the first one on it.
That was Michael Kitchens of Circuit Hawaii talking with our Russell Subiono. You also heard from Joey Batista, Jen Parker, and Mia Valero from the Sports Car Club of America, Hawaii region. This interview originally aired in 2021. That does it for today's special showcase of Hawaii's planes, trains, and automobiles. We would like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen. Our intern is Addis Belai. Additional support from HBR's digital team. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.